You are listening to the cycling podcast at the Vuelta a España in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And still out in Spain, Daniel Freib.
Hello, chaps.
We're a little bit late. We were mincing around in the podcasting gruppetto, I think, yesterday, weren't we, chaps? Yeah, and it was a bit of a hassle getting off the Aitana mountain. We're now into Sunday morning and we've got the final stage later today. But can you give us, please, Lionel, the penultimate tale of the etapa?
I certainly can, Rich. Thank you. It was stage 20, as you say. There was plenty of activity. It ran from Benidorm to the Alto de Aitana, the final climb of the Vuelta, a very climbing heavy Vuelta, when we were anticipating a bit of a showdown, a big grandstand showdown between Chris Froome and Nairo Quintana. But Froome was unable to shake the Colombian on the final climb despite a strong attack 6 kilometres from the top. Quintana followed Froome all the way, and as they rounded the final bend, the Colombian came round Froome and clinched the Vuelta. Nothing's going to unseat him today in Madrid. And Froome very magnanimously applauded his opponent as he crossed the line, which was a nice touch. The stage itself was won by Pierre Latour, a 22-year-old Frenchman with AG2R. And he's riding his first Grand Tour. I think Richard, in the first episode of our Vuelta coverage, tipped Latour as one to watch in the climbs. So he left it late, but it was an impressive win.
Did I?
I think you did, yeah. You mentioned him, yeah. Anyway, Latour was away with Darwin Atapuma. They'd been members of a 15-man counter-attacking move that got clear 110 kilometres from the finish. Earlier on, they'd been chasing Luis Leon Sanchez and Rudy Mollard, who were up the road ahead of them. But on the final climb, Sanchez dropped Mollard, and then Atapuma, Latour and Matthias Frank, who won the stage on Wednesday, bridged across. Towards the top, Latour and Atapuma went clear together, and then the Colombian attacked 400 metres from the line but was reeled in and passed by the Frenchman. Further down the mountain, although Froome could not shake Quintana, Esteban Chavez and the Orica Bike Exchange team did manage to unseat Alberto Contador, giving back Chavez the third place overall that he'd lost in the time trial on Friday. Another really impressive coup by the Orica riders. So Quintana will win the Vuelta in Madrid later on today. He also has the lead in the combined classification, but the two other jerseys changed hands yesterday on the mountain. Fabio Fellini took the green points jersey from Alejandro Valverde, and Omar Fraile of Dimension Data took the King of the Mountains jersey from Kenny Elissonde by just 1 point. Poor old Elissonde, he was really aggressive early on in the stage, trying to get the points he needed to hold off Fraile. But Fraile did a number on him. There are no climbs on the final stage to Madrid today, so the Dimension Data rider will win that competition. There we go.
Quite a few talking points. I mean, you mentioned Orica and Chavez. We'll get onto that. And also the showdown that never really happened between Quintana and Froome. It reminded me a bit of the 2010 Tour de France and the great anticipated showdown between Alberto Contador and Andy Schleck on the Col du Tourmalet, and it never really happened. But the other thing, Pierre Latour, if I didn't mention him at the start of the Vuelta, I certainly mentioned him in an episode we did of Kilometre Zero during the Tour de France on French cycling that looked particularly at FDJ and AG2R, and he was mentioned in that episode. Also, Francois Thomazeau spoke a bit about him during the Vuelta, didn't he, in the episodes that he appeared on with us. I mean, Daniel, you can tell us a bit more about him, but it was an amazing finish. I mean, I thought Atapuma had it. I thought Latour misjudged it. He did a lot, you know, in the last kilometre. Atapuma jumped him, seemed to have the gap, and I just don't know what happened. It was very odd. I mean, Latour has a very ragged style, but he clawed him back and incredibly won the stage. He has a tattoo on his on the inside of his forearm that says "Never give up" in English, and that was certainly evident in the finish of the stage.
Yeah, what actually happened was that Atapuma, poor old Darwin, got the distances wrong. I think he was told from the team car that, he was almost getting real time commentary from the team car, and they were telling him to launch his sprint, and they'd misjudged it by about 200 meters, or maybe the feed they had was on delay, or well, it would have been the other way around or something. But anyway, poor old Darwin was not very happy with the team car as he came over the line. I think he thought the finish line was 200 meters closer than it was, and consequently it all looked a bit misjudged. and he made a bit of a pickle of it. Not the first time this year that I've been at a race and a BMC leader has complained about not getting the right information from the team car. I remember Richie Port had a few words to say about that, the Dauphiné. Latour, I spoke to him at the finish line and the intention was for him to come here and target the general classification for the first time really in a major tour. And it was going okay until Formigal last Sunday, where he got caught out like many others and ended up losing over an hour. So, you know, when I said to him yesterday, who did the stage win, kind of open his eyes and about his potential as far as Grand Tours were concerned, he sort of said, well, yeah, but to be honest, it's been pretty disappointing in the sense that it's been a bit of a wake-up call losing all that time last week. But he's a very good climber. I mean, I remember the Route du Sud a couple of years ago where he was climbing with Alberto Contador and Nairo Quintana, and he's certainly got a lot of talent. Remains to be seen whether he's going to be able to develop that and also, well, develop his time trialing as well. In theory, he could be quite a good time trialist as well.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Thank you very much to Eurosport for sponsoring us at this Vuelta a España, and throughout the year, they've been showing the Vuelta, of course, every day live on Eurosport, and still lots of races to come. We'll give you details of those in the next episode of the Cycling Podcast. So there's lots more to talk about. I mean, Latour, you mentioned there before the little break, Daniel, that Latour was sort of slightly disappointed not to have shown what he could do overall, but he's only 22, so I think to come out of the Vuelta with a stage win, he should be pretty happy with that. But there were lots of other talking points. I mean, let's look at Orica. They've really sort of reinventing the sport tactically in a way. I mean, the things they've been doing, the things they've been trying this Vuelta have been really interesting to watch. I mean, there are two riders really that deserve special praise for their rides on Saturday. Damien Howson, who was in the lead group and proved a great help to Esteban Chavez once he had got away from the group. And he attacked from a long way out. It was about 45 kilometres to go. But just before Chavez jumped, Jens Kukeler, the rider who won the stage into Bilbao, which was my last stage on the Vuelta, he won a bunch sprint there, effectively, a reduced bunch sprint. But there he was on the climb, setting up Chavez's attack. And I thought, just the sense of unity that is around that team and the fact that they're all committed to whatever goals they have is very, very impressive to see. And, you know, they're trying things and they're coming off, aren't they?
Yeah, I think that's the difference, Rich. I mean, the tactics they're attempting are not necessarily that different from what we've seen teams try and very often fail with before. I mean, we've seen Movistar try pinging guys down the road and then bridging to them, and it hasn't worked very often. And it doesn't work very often, but with Orica at the moment, probably because their captains are riding so well, it is tending to work. But the execution is impressive. I mean, even down to Simon Yates yesterday attacking behind Chavez. I mean, I was standing next to Ivan Basso at the finish, and he said, "Oh, did you see what Orica did earlier?" And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, it was really subtle. There was real finesse in their tactics." And I said, "Well, yeah, I saw the house and go and the bridging move. And what do you mean?" And he said, "No, the Yates attacks. They were a masterstroke because they completely disrupted the chase. They disrupted Contador's rhythm behind, and they were absolutely key and maybe decisive in Chavez ultimately taking third place." And again, it's, you know, it's not rocket science, and they are small things, but there is a real momentum in that team at the moment. And at the moment, there's also real camaraderie still between these guys who could be competing with each other. I mean, Yates and Chavez, certainly publicly, seem to get on very well. Yesterday at the finish, they were embracing and congratulating each other. And
how could you not get on with Chavez?
Well, yeah, it's interesting, Chavez, because he's an absolute delight to the English-speaking press, certainly, and just thoroughly charming all the time. But you speak to the Colombian press about him, and they say that he's a nice guy, and they get a lot of what we get. But they also say that he's slightly more complicated than meets the eye. That not that there's an element of turning it on for the cameras, but certainly there's an edge to him, and they have a slightly different perspective from us. I mean, it was interesting watching the Colombian journalists yesterday in the Colombian TV crews, or a couple of Colombian TV crews. Not many journalists at all or TV crews on the Vuelta, but very, very strong presence from Colombia, also among the fans, of course, and also awful lot of Colombian immigrants in Spain, and they've been very vocal and a big part of this Vuelta. But the Colombian TV crews, I mean, it was like too many Christmases come at once, because they really, you know, they couldn't quite cope with Atapuma almost winning the stage, Chavez saving third place or getting third place, and then of course Quintana winning. They were flying around all over the place, you know, almost falling into ravines as they chased after, you know, one Colombian and then the next.
No, it's amazing. I mean, two Colombians on the podium. And you know, the Simon Yates tactic behind was interesting, because I think he got a bit of, he'd certainly spotted a bit of criticism for that on social media and responded to it. But I watched the Eurosport coverage of it, and interestingly, Sean Kelly called it exactly right. Sean Kelly, who was the, you know, obviously co-commentator with Carden Kirby, he knew exactly what Yates was doing, and he called it as he saw it, which was interesting, you know, having ridden himself a little bit. And, you know, Yates could do that because he was still a threat overall to one or two riders in that top 10. So they couldn't really let him go for two reasons. One, because he could move up overall, and two, because he might, you know, bridge up to Chavez possibly. So it was a masterstroke. And as you say, there's a real camaraderie in that team. They do seem all prepared to work and fight for each other. And we've seen, you know, they've won stages with some of these riders as well. So everybody's gone home happy. And the challenge, I suppose, will be how do they sustain that? But I think what's interesting, if we look at the Vuelta, and especially that top four, you know, you've got Froome and Quintana. There was a battle there for first. And then you've got behind them Contador and Chavez. And really, can we say that the difference between those riders has been the teams, that Quintana had the stronger team in Movistar and that Chavez had the stronger team in Orica?
I would agree, certainly. I mean, Contador was pretty sheepish about the strength of his team at the start of the race. I remember way back 3 weeks ago in Arense, he sort of said they'll do their best, but we know we haven't got the strongest team here. And apart from, there were flickers from them, you know, they were very strong on the day to Formigal, but it's become a bit of a disparate bunch as well, because they're all heading off in different directions next year. Contador is going to go to Trek, and he's taking a few guys with him, you know, mechanic and staff more than riders, to be honest. And they weren't particularly strong. And then Sky, again, did it in patches. And yesterday they had, you know, they supposedly had a plan, and they talked about having a plan in the morning. And talking to their riders after the finish and asking them what was the plan. The plan was just basically to make it very hard and try and shell Movistar riders on the climbs. But, you know, that looked a fairly basic, straightforward tactic and a fairly unsuccessful one compared to what Orica managed to pull off. But, of course, you know, the winner or the rider, the tactic that has success is always vindicated, is always, you know, the one that you say was right after the event.
Absolutely.
Rich, it just occurred to me, on the morning of the stage to Formigal, I spoke to Neil Stevens about Orica's tactics and their kind of GC plan and how they use the other riders supporting Chavez and Simon Yates. We didn't play that at the time because obviously there was the ambush or the fiasco of Formigal that day. But he shed quite a bit of light on how they were working and what they were trying to improve through this Vuelta, looking ahead to next year. So I wondered whether it would be worth playing that now.
Let's do that. Let's hear from Neil Stevens. Here he is.
And Neil, can you explain from a tactical point of view why you wanted to commit so many resources to moving Simon Yates up overall when you already had Esteban Chavez in a good position?
Two is better than one, I think, in any facet of life. We had Simon there quite well up the road, in a good position with the GC. Now he's even better, and it's not about Simon Yates. It's not about Esteban Chavez. It's about Orica Bike Exchange. We did really well. It was a bit of a tactical move to try to move both of the boys up, which we did. And who knows, if there had been a big blow apart, well, they might have even got together and gone ahead to both of them. But, I think it was a good tactical move by all the boys. They played it out well, and certainly we benefited from it.
How did you come up with it? And did it work out exactly as you planned, or is there an element of busking it on the road as well?
It was all planned. It's not that difficult to make a plan. But if you don't have commitment, the plan is not worth anything. And so, the magic part of the day was not the plan. The magic part of the day was the commitment, the belief, and the faith in that the boys had in each other. They knew that they had to be there. They couldn't fail. If they failed, they were failing their teammates. And so I think we should talk about a little bit less about tactics and talk about the commitment from the boys. That was the most important thing. They threw it out there. They achieved a lot. And, they should be proud of themselves.
When it comes to trying to make that kind of move, it seems to be possible in a race like the Vuelta, but we'd never see a move like that work in the Tour de France. Why do you think that is?
I can't answer that. Why not? Yeah, if I was in charge of a team in the Tour de France, I might try it, yeah. You say that, but who would have thought that Chris Froome would have attacked on a descent into a stage finish? Who would have thought that Arika Greenedge was going to send four guys up the road yesterday? That's the magic of cycling. It's a cycling that I loved it as a kid. It's something that it was my passion to watch races like that. And I think yesterday's race, it was really pleasing in that regard. You know, how many people have come and said that was the sort of thing that drew us to cycling in the beginning, and that's something that maybe more people would like to see in the future.
And lastly, when the team was formed, you didn't really have any GC ambitions at all, but in the last couple of years, you've really evolved into a powerhouse team. I mean, if all goes well, you could have podium positions in the Giro and the Vuelta, top four in the Tour de France as well. I guess a day like yesterday is also about building confidence, planning for next year, seeing what's possible, what can be done, with a goal to try to win one of these.
I think there's one word that you might have made a mistake in there. Evolved is not the word. Evolving is the word. It's all part of a plan. Yeah, we're a bunch of guys that do pretty good with the budget we've got. We've sort of formed ourselves little goals throughout, and we sort of knew that a couple of years ago we wanted to try to get up and get a GC team. We're creating, we're forming, and we're still learning as a GC team. And so, like any good team, sure, we can enjoy the results we've got now, but let's start thinking about the results we can get in a couple of years' time.
Whoever you are, wherever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world. See rafa.cc for more information.
Thank you very much to Rafa for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast, as they have done since the start of the Tour de France, and will do for the rest of this year. We're very grateful to them. We heard just before the break there from Neil Stevens, the Director Sportif at Orica Bike Exchange, or Orica Bike Edge, as I believe they're known, Lionel.
Well, in the interview, I think Neil Stevens called them Orica Green Edge, so he's not only wrong, but out of date. At least I'm just wrong.
Yeah. Hey, listen, while we remember, because I don't think you mentioned it at the start, but we should say a word about Jose Joaquin Rojas, JJ Rojas, the Movistar rider, sort of veteran sprinter type rider, who had he was in the break actually, and perhaps there to be of assistance later on in the stage if the stage had panned out differently. But he had a terrible crash. He slid on a sort of very, very innocent looking bend in the road, went under the barrier, and looked like he'd maybe got away with it because he didn't hit the barrier, but horrific injury to his leg. He posted pictures on Twitter late on Saturday night, and if you haven't seen those pictures, then I would advise you not to look them up because they're not very pleasant. And he's broken his leg basically, hasn't he? Broken the tibia. So a very, very nasty injury, and very sad for him to have to withdraw just a day before Madrid, when he would have been part of a winning team. So that's a very sad end to his Vuelta, a bit like Samuel Sanchez, who didn't start on Saturday, having crashed in the time trial on Friday. And very sad for him, especially at his stage of life and in his career. He's 38, I think, Sammy Sanchez. So that was a sad end to his Vuelta as well. But the main story on Saturday was, of course, the battle for red, the battle for the red jersey between Quintana and Froome. But it wasn't much of a battle in the end, was it? The race was pretty much done and dusted. Sky, as you mentioned earlier, Daniel, did say that they had a plan, but I think they were realistic as well. Froome gave it a go, but really, he would have needed Quintana to suffer a quite dramatic and unexpected collapse, wouldn't he?
Yeah, he would. I don't think he risked maybe as much as we thought he might. We talked the other day about how with the palmarès that Froome's got, he's in a position where he was in a position where he could have risked his second place in the Vuelta. And I think he tried a more conservative tactic than Chavez and Orica Bike Exchange. I mean, that was a high-risk tactic that they attempted. Chavez could easily have blown up and lost 4 or 5 minutes. And, you know, there was Contador breathing down his neck and other riders as well. Even Talansky could have leapfrogged over him. So you have to applaud Orica Bike Exchange. I can't even remember now. Is this Bike Exchange? Yeah. For that, and they reaped the rewards. Froome, yeah, I mean, he tried the kind of attack which might have worked if Quintana had been on a bad day, but Quintana really never looked vulnerable in this Vuelta, in the second half of the Vuelta. He was extremely strong. And again, like I said a couple of days ago, he sort of dispelled the doubts which had arisen after his Tour de France ride. And, you know, he's talked on numerous occasions during this Vuelta about his troubles with allergies during the Tour de France and how that had hampered him and how he was back to, this was his real kind of level. He was showing the kind of rider he really is on this Vuelta. And he's going to be formidable for the next 2 or 3 years because his time trialing, while he lost a fair amount of time on Saturday, is competent. It's certainly competitive. And Froome isn't going anywhere for a while. And I think this is the last time that Froome is going to come to a Grand Tour with this assortment of riders who are loosely related or loosely kind of connected to him and his plan for the season. They've all been sort of thrown together and they've tried to find some sort of cohesion in that team, but it's not Chris Froome's group. It's not his block. It's not the team that I think he wanted to bring, or he would have wanted to bring to a Grand Tour.
I think part of the issue there, and maybe you'll agree, Lionel, is that they put a very strong team into the Giro, didn't they? And a guy like Mikel Nieve, for example, who rode the Giro and the Tour, would have been a very strong ally in this Vuelta. And perhaps, I know that they were going for to try and win all three Grand Tours this year, but perhaps, you know, a start would be to try and win two Grand Tours and to really focus on trying to win two rather than trying to win three with the resources that they have.
Yeah, I mean, they never really had, Daniel, you talk about Orica Bike Exchange's tactical risk-taking, but they have the calibre of rider. I mean, if you've got Simon Yates able to make a little decoy move as he did, then that's a huge advantage. Sky really haven't got a rider capable of doing that. You know, losing Kwiatkowski was a blow early on. Obviously, that might have helped because he's strong and classy, and on certain days would have been able to ride up in the front group. Koenig's strategic advantage of being very highly placed overall evaporated at Formigal, so he was less of a card to play. And then after that, it's not looked like a team that's really been directed either by Froome or by Dario Cioni. You know, it doesn't look like a team that's all together. You know, we've seen several times Movistar all in the same place, whether even when it's just at the start line or at the start of a stage, they're all in the right place. Tinkoff making a big point of all massing at the start, particularly on that stage to Formigal, and Sky just kind of freelancing really, rather than sort of coming together as a team. And it's not just about having the firepower; it's about having a plan that everybody is executing. I mean, David Lopez can be a very helpful ally in the mountains, but it just looked like he was riding, you know, a sort of a fairly random Grand Tour rather than as part of a a clearly defined plan. And while we didn't need to see Sky all at the front doing the Movistar job because they didn't have the jersey to defend, we didn't really see them. It certainly wasn't the sort of Tour de France A team that would be able to sort of strangle the life out of their opponents.
No, Lionel, you talk about Lopez. I actually think he's come out of the Vuelta with quite a bit of credit. He's also come out of the Vuelta with a 2-year contract renewal. I remember Brailsford back in May at the Giro was pretty undecided about whether he was going to offer Lopez or whether they were going to come to an agreement about Lopez's contract. And he has got a contract renewal, so that suggests they're fairly satisfied with what he's done at the Vuelta. But they've also been pretty unlucky with injuries. Kwiatkowski obviously missed most of this Vuelta with an injury. Kenyuk had problems, but also just looking at the squad, Inchausti would have been a big player you would think for Sky this year, and he's had a virus that's pretty much wiped out his season. Landa has been unlucky with injuries, and so a lot of the sort of climbing engine room has been wiped out. Guys with Grand Tour experience, certainly as far as this Vuelta is concerned, you can imagine all of those guys might have played a key role in the Vuelta in another year. And that's the part of the team that I think they might have to replenish a little bit in the off-season, particularly with guys like Koenig leaving. I mentioned Jonathan Castroviejo. I think there might be interest in him, but they probably do need, certainly if Froome's going to go and try and win the Vuelta again, they need more of those strong, experienced all-rounders. The kind of guy that we've seen Quintana benefit from.
Although we're having the opposite discussion to when we had at the Tour, where Sky were so strong that it led to calls for reduced numbers in the teams, and here and Movistar were very, very disappointing at the Tour, and they've been very impressive here. So it's just that it's personnel, isn't it? But as you say, Sky, there's a couple of riders in Chausti. He's had glandular fever. A few people were asking about him. He was a Giro stage winner last year, sort of guy who would have been extremely useful in a race like this. And they have been unlucky. I mean, Landa as well. They've certainly not had the best of Landa. So I'm not sure if they need to replenish. If those guys come back fit next year, that could answer the question.
That's true, Rich. But you think about Chris Froome, you think about the team he has brought here, but also just his wider kind of entourage. I mean, I'm struggling to remember a very strong Grand Tour, multiple Grand Tour winner over the last 15, 20 years who hasn't had a more clearly defined block of personnel. And that, that applies to domestiques. And so whether they've done whether it's been the Tour or the Vuelta or the Giro for a particular star, they've always had an inner circle that's gone everywhere. And Froome, Froome, apart from, maybe his mechanic, Gary Blair, even down to the director sportif, Dario Cioni's been here, and usually it's been Nicolas Portal who's overseen all of Froome's Tour de France victories, actually. So that's curious, and I think that's something that Froome might have given him food for thought, I think, this Vuelta.
It's true, yeah, because you talk about Alberto Contador, he'll go to Trek with a huge entourage. I mean, Basso, Stephen de Jong, I think, are going there, as well as riders, backroom staff. Look at Peter Sagan going to Bora with a bit of an entourage as well. That tends to be what happens. It's not just Grand Tour winners, it's the stars tend to have the inner circle of Froome move teams. He would probably take Gary Blehm with him and maybe a couple of other backroom staff, but I can't think of any riders that he would take with him. On Trek, by the way, I caught a plane with Luca Guercellina from Bilbao to Milan, an EasyJet flight, and I was sitting just behind him, and he's a general manager at Trek Segafredo, and mid-flight, the plane dropped, basically, and rocked to the side. A flight attendant was thrown into a row of people. There were screams, there was genuine panic, and Guercellina was just completely unruffled, didn't flinch. Very impressive, I thought.
What did you do, Rich?
I screamed.
Did you?
Oh, it was terrifying.
Had you spilled your gin and tonic?
It was the most scary experience I've ever had in a flight. Oh. It was awful, but he was completely unruffled, and I spoke to him as we got off the plane. He didn't even seem to have registered it, to be honest, but he talked about how they're building an extremely strong team for next year. They've got John Degenkolb as well, of course, but they're signing up a lot of strong riders from you know, like I am cycling, and one or two teams that are folding, and they will be a very strong outfit next year. Let's hear from somebody who will in Madrid finish his 48th consecutive Grand Tour.
Not quite that many, Rich. No, this is his 16th consecutive Grand Tour. It's Adam
48?
Hansen.
Where did you get that from?
It was a joke.
That would make him quite a lot older than that's 16 years worth, isn't it? Oh no, hang on.
He's going for 22, isn't he?
I think so. Well, yeah. At the end, I ask him whether it's on the plan for 2017 as well. We'll hear from him just now. But yeah, he's Adam Hansen's quite extraordinary, really. He's very laid back. He clearly has a temperament for Grand Tour racing. He rode the 2011 Vuelta, and since then he has started and finished all three Grand Tours every year. So that's a run of 16 in a row. It's 336 days of racing if you add it all together. So if you stretch that from the start of the year, January the 1st, it runs all the way to early December, I think it is. I mean, it's quite an impressive run, considering he's had a couple of Grand Tours where he's crashed or been under the weather, and perhaps had he not got this run going, might have called it a day. But a model of consistency. So this is Adam Hansen, who, when he rides into Madrid and crosses the line on Sunday evening, will complete his 16th Grand Tour in a row.
Good morning, Adam. I guess we can say you're the authority on the Grand Tours, having ridden so many of them consecutively. But this year, which has been your favourite of the three? I know the Vuelta's not quite over, but which has been the most enjoyable for you?
Probably the Giro this year. I think it's the nicest one. The Tour is very stressful. This one's been rather difficult. So, yeah, definitely the Giro for this year.
And they've all got very different characters, have they? Can you describe the differences between the Vuelta and the other two?
The Vuelta's normally very relaxed, late starts. You get to sleep in as long as you want. So it's a lot of free time in the mornings, which is good, and it's low-key. And the mountains are more towards the end, so it's the racing's a bit easier. The Giro is probably the hardest one to finish. It's very difficult. It's the profile of the mountains is extremely hard, long stages, the weather can be bad, things like this. And the Tour is super fast, super stressful, lots of pressure, huge crowds, full media, no spare time, and it's just full on from start to finish.
It's been very hot this Vuelta, and the racing has been intense. Does that suit you?
Yeah, I like the heat. It's been good. Coming to third week now, so I'm a bit better than my first 2 weeks. So yeah, it just normally does suit me a bit better.
And what is it about this streak? It stretched to 5 years now. I think it began with the 2011 Vuelta, and you've ridden every day of every Grand Tour since. Why did it suit you to do the Grand Tours more than perhaps weeks long stage races and one day races and the other things that are on at this time of year?
Well, like 3 weeks away and 3 weeks of continuous racing, and it's nice. It's you know, you have a lot of opportunities here in comparison to single day races or 1 week races, and there's always a chance. So the three-week races, I think, they're better suited to me. I think my level of fitness is better for it. And I enjoy it. I enjoy the three countries.
And what about your role in the team? Does that change between the different races?
Oh, for sure. The role changes quite a lot in the team. At the Tour, it's all for Andre and all for the team. In the Giro, I have a bit of a free card, but Andre came this year, so it's more for Andre also. And then, here, it's a bit of more of a free role also. So it's, you know, they're all different, which is good, and I have my space in everyone.
Are you continuing with Lotto Soudal next year? And if so, have you already talked to them about whether you want to do all three Grand Tours again in 2017?
Yes, I will continue with them, and I will do all three again.
Excellent. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
The Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa.
Okay, so we heard there from Adam Hansen. Let's just play one other interview, because he was in the break again on Saturday. Lilian Camajan, a guy who won a stage, I think it was stage four, wasn't it, right at the beginning of the Vuelta, who it seems so long ago now that it's almost remarkable that he's still there in the race. And he did tell me when I spoke to him that his ambition was to try and win another stage. So he was in the break on Saturday. But most of all, I was keen to clear up something that some of our listeners brought up, which was that he spent some time in Nottingham at university there. So at the start one morning while I was on the Vuelta, I spoke to the Direct Energy rider Lilian Camajan. Here he is. Lilian, it must seem a while now since your stage win, but have you had a lot of time to reflect on that?
Yeah, it's a wonderful stage. It's a win a stage in the Vuelta. It was something that I doesn't expect at the beginning, but in my dream maybe yes, but it was the objective. But win a stage, it's something special for first year as a pro.
Does it make you rethink, you know, what you might be capable of?
Yeah, since the beginning of the year, I do some good results. I show that I had the level on World Tour, for example, Paris-Nice. I was in good shape. But yeah, it's hard to say at other in the team and to be confident to say I will win a stage in Vuelta. But you have to believe in you. It's very important in the sport to improve each year.
Now, you speak very good English, and we understand that you spent some time in Nottingham studying.
Yeah, I did a business school after my bac in French, it's a baccalaureate. And then I spent 3 months and a half in Nottingham in an internship. And yeah, it was very good experience. I bring my bike to not lose the level, and I did some good trainings there. I did also lots of meeting with people who is very interesting. When I was there, I was living with 5 people in a house. It was co-location, and it was a very good experience with Italian, Spanish, and to learn English. It was very, very good and easier for me because, you know, you have the difference of accent with a foreigner and a pure English. But yeah, it was definitely a good experience.
A few of our listeners to the Cycling Podcast remember you also racing some of the 10-mile time trials.
Yeah. At the beginning, I did just training, and I was looking for competition because I'm a competitor. So I was checking on forum and some information to do race. And I saw that in Nottingham, there were lots of meetings like this, 10 to 10 miles time trial. I don't add my time trial bike there, but I did some good results, and I remember that people were surprised by my result, and it was.
I think you're the only Vuelta stage winner to come from the Nottingham Clarion 10-mile time trial.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know, but it's. I think in France we don't have this kind of event. We have cyclosportive, we have event for rider, but I think that French will be inspired by English. It will be a good idea because Frenchmen are not so good in time trial. In time trial, it's very good discipline. The track also, and because English in track, you know that it's the best nation. So I hope that in the future this kind of event in France could be possible.
So that was Lilian Calmejean raving about the British time trial scene and his time in Nottingham. And another, you know, we had a young French winner on Saturday, but he's another good prospect for France. So listen, I think we should wrap things up there, chaps. You've got to get to Madrid still, haven't you, Daniel?
Yep, very much so.
Well, you get to Madrid, and we'll reconvene again later to discuss tonight's stage in our final Vuelta podcast. In the meantime, thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thanks, Rich. Thanks, Napalm.